Okay, we are live, gentlemen. We are live. I am here with Alexander Beckhurst, the Oracle of London, and with the one and only Mr. Garland Nixon. Garland, good to have you on again. It is a pleasure to have you here with us. Before we get started, where can people find you, Garland?
Well, I am on of course, at Garland Nixon on Twitter, online. You can find, of course, my YouTube page and Rockfin, which is rockfin.com/GarlandNixon. Those are my online places, homes, as it were.
Fantastic. And I will have everything as a pinned comment down below when the stream ends. And I have everything in the description box right now where you can find Garland. Highly recommended that all of you subscribe to his channel. And Garland, you put together over the past couple of weeks just some great streams covering a lot of topics. But today we are going to talk about what is going on in Ukraine, in Kherson, and maybe if you and Alexander tie in some of the stuff with the midterm elections and perhaps how foreign policy may shape up to be in the United States and with regards to Ukraine as well. There's a lot of talk about how the Biden White House and Congress may approach Ukraine if any changes happen at all. So before we get started, let me just say a quick hello to everyone that is watching us on Rockfin. Hello to everyone that is joining us on Rockfin. Hello to everyone that is joining us on Rumble, on Odyssey, and on YouTube. Hello to our locals community as well, and to our moderators, Zariel, Valies, and myself. Hello to all the moderators. Let's get rolling. Alexander, are you ready? Are you ready to
Absolutely, of
jump in?
course.
All right,
Yes, absolutely ready.
let's begin. Let's begin,
Let's begin.
everybody.
Let's be
Quite a week of news. Quite a
well,
week of news.
absolutely. Well, and a very much a week of news. Now, I mean, we've got big events going on in Ukraine. We've had the Russian pullout from Kherson, west of the Dnieper. I think it's perhaps just useful to point out that 60% of Kherson region is east of the Dnieper and is therefore still under Russian control. What they have abandoned is the area west of the Dnieper, but that, of course, includes Kherson City. And we got confirmation today from the Russian Defense Ministry that they've pulled all their troops across. They've destroyed the bridges behind them. It's an orderly, well-organized retreat. Now, there were lots of signals it was coming. I'm not going to pretend I didn't think it would happen, but clearly the military have been pushing for it for a long time. The Russian military have been pushing for it for a long time. They say it was difficult to keep the troops supplied. And the general in charge, a man called Suravikin, has also told us that he thought that there was no logic in keeping 20,000 men in a small area, relatively small area, defending when they could be used more usefully in other places. Having said which, it's been a bit of a shock for a lot of people that it's happened. But this time, I would say the Russians managed the optics much better. When there was that collapse in Kharkiv in September, there was no real explanation of how it had happened. We were just suddenly found that they were pulling out. This time, it was signaled well in advance. We had Suravikin coming along on television with Shoigu, the defense minister, saying, you know, this is what we must do. We've got to pull these troops out. They're not serving any purpose there. And of course, the supply problems are difficult and getting worse. They've never lost a battle in Kherson region. They've carried out an orderly withdrawal. And my impression is that the mood in Russia is calm. In other words, this has been received calmly, which is a contrast to what happened, as I said, when they pulled out of Kharkiv region back in September. And of course, people like Kadyrov, Prigozhin, the hardliners, they've actually supported this move. So that's a sign that they're getting the optics right. What it means for the longer war, well, we'll discuss that in more detail with Garland. And the interesting thing is that all of this is happening in combination with a flurry, a sudden flurry of diplomatic activity. And none of it is coming from the Russians. In fact, it seems to be originating with the United States. And we've had Jake Sullivan going to Kiev, apparently telling Zelensky, well, you must sit down and talk. We've now had General Milley, apparently, this is, I believe it's in the Washington Post today. He's apparently also coming around and saying that this is the time to start negotiations for Ukraine to cement its gains, because it's not going to achieve anything more from this point. So suddenly the US is showing some interest in negotiations. But when I say the US, we're always talking about a very divided administration. We wonder what exactly other people in the administration, the more hardline neocons, are thinking, whether they're seeing this as an opportunity to keep up the offensive, or whether they will continue to support these negotiations if negotiations happen. I should say that Peskov, who's Putin's spokesman, gave a statement today in which he said that Kherson, including Kherson city, remains Russian, and that cannot change. And he's also said that they've seen no sign of any negotiations, of any willingness to negotiate from Kiev. So that's the Ukraine side of things, I think. But Garland will have much to say about that. And of course, we also have the other side, which is the midterms, which I have to say were unexpected for me, because again, I'd been led to think that there was going to be this red tide. The Republicans would win big in the House of Representatives, might even gain the Senate. It doesn't look like that at all. It's not even clear to me at the moment that they're going to win the House of Representatives. So I'd be very interested to know what Garland's thoughts are about that, and whether this is going to have any bearing on the foreign policy of the Biden administration. So over to you, Garland. What do you think about the... Let's start with Ukraine. What do you think this all means? I mean, this pullout from Kherson, is it the end of the war? Is it the beginning of the war? Is it a withdrawal that points to more withdrawals looking forward? Or is it the Russians, as they say, rebuilding their forces in the east? They've got all these 300,000 men coming in. They're preparing for an offensive. Surovikin actually spoke about offensives on the way.
A couple of things. I think that the Kherson move is a pretty straightforward tactical move. If you look at the facts on the ground, it's very easy to understand from a military perspective why they did that, and it makes a lot of sense. The issue that Russia had to deal with was, how do they do this in a manner that they don't get pushback, that they don't get anger at home, based on what happened in September with the errors that were made. They were overstretched, as we know, and the Ukraine was able to walk into a few areas and claim that as a major strategic victory. I think what they did, a couple of things, the reason that there's been a much softer landing this time. Number one, they brought in a new general, and they did, even though it was fairly mild, they did a bit of a PR offensive with him at home. Mm-hmm. They put him on television. They interviewed him. The Kadyrov and Prigozhin came out and, you know, gave him their blessings. Okay, we like this guy. He's good. They introduced him to the public in a way that convinced the Russian people that he was a wise general and that he should be trusted. Once they created an environment of trust at home, he was in a position to make difficult positions. And I believe that when he came in from the very beginning, he said, we got to get out of here, son, ASAP. And they said, okay. But the discussion was, how do we do that? We can get out, but how do we do that in a way that, having you know, suffered this PR disaster, that we don't suffer PR disaster part two? And they start compounding and getting worse. So they did the public relations move with him out there. And again, as we can see in hindsight, we started seeing a number of implications that something was afoot. They started, he came in immediately and said, I may have to make decisions, you know, flags are going down, all kinds of things are happening. So that by the time he was ready to make the move, the public had been prepared that there could be some difficult decisions that he would make, and that they should trust him militarily to make those decisions. I think it was a, you know, people say that we often hear that the Russians are not good with public relations. Well, I don't think they're as concerned with the information, the broad information war in the West. The U.S. information war targets its own citizens. So I don't think they were concerned with that. I think they were concerned with, we have to make some practical moves and we have to prepare our people at home. And I think they did a very good job of that, because again, anybody who looks at this, tactically speaking, says it makes sense. It makes good sense. And they're, you know, from a long-term strategy, you know, you can see why they did it. And here's a clue that it was a good strategic move. Not just tactical, but strategic. And that is, the Ukrainian troops, you know, the Russians have left Kherson and said, there it is. It's all yours. Come get it. And the Ukrainians are sitting back saying, we don't know if we want to move in so fast, because if it was a trap for the Russians, then it's certainly a trap for you. The PR, public relations opportunity that they created for the Ukrainians to say, we left, and now you can just come in and take it. That's the cheese in the trap. Because if they take it, then the Russians can say, okay, now you're easily surrounded. We can blow the dam if we want. You know, not that they would, but they have the opportunity to do all of the things that the Ukrainians could have potentially did. So let's watch and see if the Ukrainians, how happy they are and how much of a rush they are to come in and to reassume those positions that the Russians have vacated and left, who knows, booby-trapped, whatever the case may be, certainly sighted in for all kinds of munitions. If I were the Ukrainians, I would not be in a hurry to jump back into Kherson.
I would agree with that, actually. I mean, I think that they will send some people there, and they apparently already raised some flags. But I gather the city is largely empty. I mean, I think most of the people were evacuated out. So, I mean, it's an empty place to all intents and purposes. There's still some people there, obviously, but mostly it's been emptied now. So what do you think is going to happen? I mean, Suravikin talked about offensives. Do you think there's going to be an offensives? I do. I think we're going to see big offensives coming in the east. I mean, he's building up his forces there. He's already managed to, the Russian troops have now captured this village. It's only a village, Pavlovka, but it apparently leads on to another place, Ugladar. And Suravikin also spoke optimistically about the situation in Bakhmut. I call it Bakhmut. But do you think there's going to be a big offensive?
Well, you know, I hate to seem like I'm waffling, but I think it is a reasonable thing to do, to look at both possibilities. Number one, why wouldn't there be an offensive if I were in charge? Well, time is on my side, so I don't have to do an offensive. One of the moves could be to continue to make it very uncomfortable for Ukrainian civilians, and now the West has to deal with a massive influx of refugees, and it gets more difficult for the Ukrainian military. So as you kind of wait things out, and of course we know what's going on behind the scenes as the European civilians get more and more restless over the economic troubles that they're facing. So the Russians are not, they don't have any time constraints, so they could kind of wait this thing out for a while. On the other hand, of course, certainly, rather than major offensives, as the Ukrainians weaken, they could launch a number of offensives in places, you know, such as Bakhmut, in areas that they find critical. They could continue to deteriorate the ability of the Ukrainian troops to resupply, things of that nature, and continue to weaken them so that when they are prepared for an offensive, they can easily mount one. with minimum resistance. So I would suspect they are digging in. And again, based on what they've said, I would suspect that there is a lot of digging in going here, weakening your enemy and preparing so that when and if the time is right, you're waiting for just the right time, when and if the time is right, they can make a move.
You know, Surovikin, he gave that interview to Russian television. It was very interesting because what he said was, we're not going to go in for big offensives. We're going to grind the Ukrainians down. I mean, that was how he said that was going to be his strategy, that he was going to continue to grind the Ukrainian army down until eventually, presumably, Ukraine was either forced to negotiate or basically, I suppose, collapses. What is the feeling about all of this in the US? I mean, I'd say here in Britain, we're very gung-ho in support of Ukraine. It's a big topic here. You still find, I was in the English regions, I was traveling through the English regions, I still find the old Ukrainian flag in people's houses. The media here has pushed the whole Ukraine thing relentlessly. It's still a big topic of news. What do people in the US think about this? Is this a big news topic in the US? Or are people concerned about other things?
Surprisingly, the Kherson offensive is not as big a news topic as you would think. I think even some of the pundits and some of the military people are moving slowly and kind of recognizing that it's not may not be the opportunity that they'd like it to be. And additionally, the entire country has been completely and totally distracted by the midterms. The Democrats of certainly Biden and his people are trying to spin what happened in the midterms as a victory, even though it wasn't technically a victory. It was they held on to some things and it was razor close. I would like to make a few comments on the midterms I've been thinking about, if you don't mind, to add into this, because I think the military aspect of it, as you gentlemen know, is inextricably linked to the political aspect. It's because this is a multifaceted war. In the midterms, many people, including me, expected a significant victory by the Republicans. But now that we can kind of look back and do a little bit of a historical review, if we think about this, I'll just make this quick. 2004, 2006, the Iraq War was going on, the Afghanistan, the U.S. had, after 2001, had really, switched to a major offensive war footing. The Democrats ran opposing the Iraq War, and they blew the Republicans out, destroyed them. There was a blowout, right? 2008, Obama comes in, albeit, his arguments were false and misleading. However, he ran as somewhat of an anti-war candidate, and there was a complete blowout. So 2006, 2008, those were the last blowouts. 2016, everyone expected Clinton to win. Her and Trump, they went toe-to-toe. And while all of the polls and everything said Clinton wins in a blowout, it was razor close. 2020. Most people expected with what happened with happened with Donald Trump's, particularly with COVID, and there was economic issues at the time, and all of the traditional political signals said Donald Trump should win. If not a blowout, it should be a substantial loss, razor close. What I think is this: we've gotten to a point where these two parties are so similar that neither of them is going to put together a platform that separates it from the other.
I didn't understand that.
Sorry about that. There's Google's over there listening to me, as always. The guys in Langley, they've got to get paid too, so you got to give them their respect. But at any rate, so what happens is the Republicans could have had a blowout. They could have. That opportunity was there. But over the last several months, every time the Democrats wanted something else, another $20 billion for Ukraine, which wasn't popular amongst the populace, the Republicans would all vote with few exceptions in favor, very few exceptions. The Republicans, even though leading up to the election, there were scattered some Republicans and some MAGA Republicans that were actually questioning the money. The leaders of the Republican Party were still kind of winking and nodding, saying, yeah, they're saying that, but trust me, when we get back in, this money's going to keep flowing. And the people read the tea leaves. And ultimately, the only thing you end up with now, this is why we're just going to have close elections, because the only thing you end up with now is the faithful of each party coming out. And it's going to be razor thin one way or the other, unless one of the parties separates itself with a concrete foreign or domestic policy proposal or suite of proposals that's different from the others. As long as they just sit there and say, you know, we're not them, they're not us, they're going to both get their faithful followers out, and it's going to be razor thin one way or the other. That's what we can expect in 2024. Although I will argue that the Democrats have a very devious plan for 2024 that could have some success at the expense of the EU.
Right. Well, perhaps you could tell us what it is, because I mean, you can't just dangle that in front of us, Garland, and leave us waiting.
So okay, this is, and I haven't heard anyone say this, but okay. What Joe Biden came in saying was, I'm going to bring jobs back. Basically, his argument is, I'm going to reindustrialize the United States. I'm going to bring jobs back. I'm going to bring industry back. And everyone said, well, you can't do that. You know, a lot of people looked at it and we said, well, you can't do that because it would have to come back from China and we can't compete labor-wise, right? Well, if you're a neocon and you're thinking, I need to bring industry back here so I can compete with China, what if they are actually recognizing that a financialized industry can't compete? We do have some commodities. We have oil and gas, so we have commodities, right? But they're recognizing that this financialized, they're not stupid. This financialized economy can't compete with the industrialized economy and the commodity economy of Russia. You've got to reindustrialize. So what do? You've got to get that industry from somewhere. You take it from the EU. So what do? You turn off the gas to the EU so that their industry can no longer afford. You can't keep in mind, where does capital flow to? Where does industry go to? What happened in the US? US industry looked at China and said, labor and cost are cheaper. I'm picking up out of here and I'm going to China. And they already know that. So you want to reindustrialize here so you can compete with China. There's no other way. So you say, well, we've got to make it cheaper here. In fact, the Europeans are kind of, some of them are starting to wake up and say, wait a minute, what is this Inflation Reduction Act? This is part of that plan. So what they do is you cut off the economic model, which is cheap energy from Russia, for the EU. The EU deindustrializes, you do this Inflation Reduction Act, you set up an environment where it's very welcoming for industry, you steal all the industry from the EU, you reindustrialize, you bring the jobs back, you certainly from the perspective of the neocons, the EU is disposable in the same way that Ukraine is disposable. Now, going into 2024, you say, look at all these jobs I brought back. Things are looking good. People are expecting that the EU's economy will die and ours will. What if ours won't? What if we just reindustrialize from the EU, reinflate our economy? Our economy gets stronger. The EU is disposable. You throw that empty husk of what once was a great society aside, and boom, you're ready to go and your economy's strong again. And now they're ready to economically be in a position to compete with China at the expense of the EU industry.
It's extraordinary because it's a predatory approach to your own allies. I mean, you feed on them. I mean, it's like, it's like Saturn devouring his children, in effect. I mean, it's an extraordinary, I think, by the way, that this is a pretty good summary of what is going on and probably was to some extent planned. But, you know, historically, I mean, I was born in the 60s and I could still remember the time when the United States was coming into Europe, giving money to Europe, building up Europe, because of course that was its geostrategic interest at that time. And this was true in Greece, but it was much more true in Germany and all across Europe with Marshall Aid and all those sort of things. And, you know, that legacy was still very strong, that the memory of all of that was still very vivid in the 1960s. And now the United States is doing the reverse. It's now feeding off its allies. I wonder how long given that is so, they can realistically remain allies?
Well, as long as it takes, you know, I mean, I'll put it like this, you know, and, you know, of all the old fables of fattening the goose for the holidays, right? Well, they only need to keep the continue to fatten the goose until the holidays get here, and then it's time to eat. And after that, after that, you throw the bones aside, you're done with it. They kept Europe strong and they kept their economy go strong as long as that benefited them. Yeah. Now they need economy, they just grab it and they take it home because times are getting difficult. Before, they could prey on the resources of the global South. They could go to Africa. They could go to Russia. They could go to South America. Well, now they have competition there. Russia and China are going there. And Russia and China are not so much preying on those areas of the world as they are doing business with them. So a predatory system, the predator has run out of rabbits. Now it's time to eat deer. Deer's bigger than a rabbit, but when you get hungry, you got to eat something. And so they fattened them up. And now, unfortunately for the EU, it's time for the US to reindustrialize at the expense of the EU. And here's the other thing I think that is important. The leaders of the EU, they are not innocent bystanders here. The leaders of the EU are not stupid. The leaders of the EU, while the people of the EU felt that they had independence and sovereignty, the leaders of the EU always knew they didn't. And in fact, their jobs were to maintain the illusion of independence and sovereignty while they reported to their bosses in Washington, D.C. And now their jobs are to hold off the people as long as they can. When it's all said and done, I always say, if you want to know how this thing ends up, just look at Afghanistan. In the end of these operations, some guys get jumping on a plane with suitcases full of money and they're falling out of the back. These guys all expect to end up in some gated neighborhood just south of Miami, and they'll leave Europe behind. And of course, what's going to happen in Europe? What always happens? What happened in Iraq? What happened in Afghanistan? First, the very wealthy leave. Then those who are doctors or lawyers or who have marketable skills, they go to another country where they can make a good living with those skills. And what you end up left with in Europe is a working class with no work and very, very angry people. And at that point, they've been discarded anyway. Yeah. The wealthy class has removed themselves to Turkey. It's cheap to live in Turkey, and they seem like they're smart enough to make a deal with Russia. And the other countries, the Saudi Arabias, the Turkeys of the world, they understand this dynamic. That's why they're shifting away, because they already know with the EU, right, with the US right now, it's either be eaten or get out of the flock. And they are making a run for it.
Yeah. And what you're describing, of course, is a classic empire. I mean, empires are basically extractive operations. I mean, you extract the wealth of your vassals. And of course, you have in your vassals, your colonies, if you like, you have the sort of people that are there who are, you know, the collaborators. they run the place to a great extent on your behalf, but they do it on your behalf, not on behalf of the people who are there. If you've studied the British Empire, that is exactly how it worked. The British Empire was a giant operation in extracting wealth from the colonies to the center. And that seems to me what the United States now unabashedly is.
Yes. And also, you know, another interesting similarity is what the British Empire did. Oftentimes, if they had some colony out in Africa or whatever, some nobleman's son who was a ne'er-do-well who could, you know, was causing trouble, they would say, you're going out to whatever this country is, and you're going to be a governor there, you're going to be a viceroy there. And they get rid of him so that he didn't embarrass the father, the nobleman at home, right? So what you ended up with was the most inept and corrupt leaders of these colonies that you could possibly find, because they were discarded. Look at the people who are running the U.S. colonies in Europe now. They are the most corrupt. It's a kakistocracy, the most inept and corrupt people they can find running them. And it's an embarrassment. But the U.S. just has to have these people hold out long enough. And let me reconnect it to Ukraine. I think the U.S. all along planned a winter PR offensive. And that winter PR offensive was this. We all could look at this and we could say, this thing's going to fall apart. The people are going to hit the streets in Europe as soon as they feel the pain. And there's going to be political and social destabilization in Europe. I think the U.S.'s plan, as they're executing it right now, is this. As that starts to happen, we'll create the illusion that we're ready to negotiate. We'll start saying, oh, we're going to talk, and we'll leak things to the Washington Post and blah, blah, blah. And we'll get everybody's hopes up and we'll see how long we can hold them off with that. Just how long we can hold. They have absolutely no intention of actually, having a discussion with Russia, because since the plan here is to maintain world hegemony, to actually have any kind of negotiation with Russia would be an absolute loss. It would mean you're not the hegemon anymore. You're not in charge of the world because you've been forced by Russia to negotiate with them. So they can never, ever, ever think of negotiation. But they're looking and they're like, okay, things are getting a little tough in Europe. We got to hold these people off. Time to play the fake negotiation card. And we'll put out all kinds of strange and contradictory things, and people will discuss it as to, well, what is this? Does this make sense? But that contradicts that. Are they trying to do that? The longer they keep us talking, the longer they can hold us off while they get that industry the heck out of Europe and get it and move it to Elkhart, Indiana.
That's right. I certainly think, I've been reading Russian commentaries there. I mean, they are completely skeptical about these diplomatic moves, which they have not been contacted about. There's been some suggestion that the United States wants to resume arms limitation talks with Russia. That's to say, new start. In other words, restrictions on nuclear weapons. But the Russians are cynical about that, too, because they don't believe that the US is really interested in getting New START moving, because of course its major concern now is no longer the Russian nuclear forces, but the fact that the Chinese are building up their nuclear forces, and that the United States is just going through the motions again of starting negotiations that it has no real intention of seeing through. Having said that, I mean, even if we don't get negotiations going this winter, the very fact that people are talking about negotiations may reflect a real need for some kind of settlement. I was traveling around the English regions this week, and I have to say there is a great deal of distress there. I mean, you see businesses shut down, you see, shops closed. I was in a town, Princetown, famous place. It was the site of the story of the Hound of the Baskervilles. The most famous business there has closed. Everywhere across England, there's a sort of sense of, undoubted decline. And though we don't like to talk about the fact that it's Ukraine related, I mean, the political class certainly knows that. And I think it's starting to sort of percolate through to the general population. If there is even talk of negotiations, people might start saying, well, actually, this is a good idea. We need negotiations. We need to settle. So I could see how this could get out of control, actually.
Yes, but keep in mind, Angela Baerbock gave the game away a while back when she said, I don't really care what the German people think. We're going to do what we're going to do. She made it clear at that point. She probably took a lot of heat from the elite ruling class because, it was like, shush, you're not supposed to say that. That's the game in Europe, but you're not supposed to tell them. She didn't have enough sense to say that. So at this point,
we've lost him. Alex, are you still there?
Yeah, we lost him. I was muted. We lost Garland. He'll be back.
We lost Garland. He'll be back. There he is.
What happened? I just popped out.
Sorry.
Suddenly, it just said, "Oops, something went wrong." And as I always say,
it was the Google guys that were listening.
Yeah,
to you,
they've got to make a living, so we got to respect those guys.
Yeah, but please continue. Please continue.
So at any rate, we do have a corrupt and inept ruling class that is completely separated from the people. And now it's not how do I address the needs of the people; it's how do I hold them off while I execute the plan that is not in their best interest. So now we have Rishi Sunak coming in saying, oh, I'm going to do all of these things. You know, it's kind of, there was a famous Russian writer, I don't remember which one it was, who talked about the elite ruling class who has their boot on your neck, and they say, we're willing to do anything to help you, except take our boot off of your neck, right? And this is where it is. The economic war of attrition against Russia is causing the problems. And what they're saying is, we're willing to do anything to address your suffering, except address the root cause. And so now they're just going to do, and now that they're just going to do the usual neoliberal things that they do. What Europe is experiencing is what countries all over the world has experienced for many, many years. This is what the US is doing. Unfortunately, the UK and other countries, you know, whether it's Venezuela or Bolivia or on and on, has assisted them. And now the chickens are coming home to roost, unfortunately, for the people of the EU. And I can only hope that they, I think the only hope they have is a general strike. But not a general strike. You know, the general strike is, we want more money. That's not going to do you any good. You're going to get more money. They'll just print it and hand it to you and drive up inflation anymore. The problem in Europe is a lack of independence and sovereignty. And unless they move to another party or another political presence and regain their independence and sovereignty, there is no other way out for the European public and the European working class.
Let's look at the other side. What are the Russians and the Chinese doing light of all of this? I mean, they can see that you know, the US is busy rebuilding itself at the expense of its allies. I mean, what are the Chinese in particular, what are they thinking, do you think? I mean, what is their approach to all of this? Because they must know that this is all ultimately directed at them. They are the challenge. They are the people who, if anybody is going to replace the United States as the world's most powerful country, it can only be China. So what are the Chinese going to do in response to all of this? Or are they just going to sit and exercise patience and wait the Americans out?
I think there are a couple of things going on here. I think the Chinese certainly realize that they need to build up and beef up their defensive capabilities to a point where the U.S. is extremely reticent to tangle with them militarily. So I think militarily in the short run to intermediate run, their plan is get militarily stronger, make the U.S., you know, interestingly enough, what the U.S. says they want to do to Taiwan, we want to make Taiwan a prickly porcupine, blah, blah, blah. I think that's what they want, the Chinese want to do. But I also think, if I were the Chinese and the Russians, I'd be looking at Europe, because the US sees three competitors: Europe, China. You know, these are the three big markets: Europe, China, and Russia. They're already taking out one out of three, because one of the three, the Europeans, don't realize that they've been targeted for attack. So they're easy, they're gravy. I think in the long run, the Chinese and the Russians, and we're already starting to see some moves where the Chinese are starting to, you know, kind of put their arm around the Germans a little bit. Hey guys, you know, you're selling a lot of Mercedes and BMWs here. We want to be friends. I think there is a recognition that at some point, whether it's the elite ruling class or the people, that Europe is going to wake up either before they're totally deindustrialized and basically turned into Haiti, or after, which they'll have no chance, but they'll wake up in squalor. But recognizing that at some time, and I've said this from the very beginning, Russia is a much more natural diplomatic and economic partner and reliable in both of those areas partner for Europe than the US. So I think both of them, I would be looking at the long run saying, I think at some point, the Europeans are going to do what the Saudis are doing. The Saudis are looking back and forth and saying, if they'll do that to Europe, they'll do it to us. The Turks, the wise countries, are waking up saying, we're going to move in the direction of the people that we can trust. So I think they're also realize with time, they're just going, I think, and if you look at Putin, he's not, I hate the Europeans. He's still saying, guys, if you want gas, we can work something out. He's saying, I'm going to set up some things with the Turks so we can have a hub to get gas into Europe. And people are looking at it like, Europe's never going to buy your gas again. What are you talking about? I think both of them recognize that the time will come when Europe will need help, when Europe will recognize that they've been had and that they will start looking around, and there will be some very, very powerful, the SCO, the BRICS, there will be some very, very powerful economic options for them. And I think that's what they're going to, the Chinese and the Russians are ultimately holding out for. I think that's an intermediate to long term. But at the rate that the U.S. is in deindustrializing Europe, it may not be as long as we think. And I think that's that Olaf Scholz to China thing. I think that's the beginning of it. And Olaf Scholz may be smacked down for that by the Greens. But let's not forget, he had a bunch of big CEOs with him, a bunch of powerful German CEOs. Let's not overlook the fact that, you know, they have a stake in it here, and they're not going out as easy as one might think.
That's absolutely right. I mean, Germany has prospered over the last 30 years on the basis of cheap Russian gas and developing the Chinese market. And I don't think the German CEOs will want to lose the Chinese market after they've lost the cheap Russian gas. No, I agree with that. And it was interesting that Putin was again, in one of his recent speeches, he was again talking about, you know, the Eurasian, you know, the greater Eurasia, the idea, you know, that all these various parts of Eurasia, Europe, Russia, Central Asia, China, they should all cohere. That's a natural fit. But of course, no one in Europe that I can see, outside perhaps a few German CEOs, thinks in that way. I've never seen anybody in Britain, for example, even acknowledge this idea of a Eurasian partnership. So how do you break through the sort of media dominance that there is on this?
Well, I think through pain. I think we go back to the 1920s, you know, America's roaring and everybody's getting money in and blah, blah, blah. And people are dancing around and the Great Gatsby and things of that nature. Mm-hmm. And what happens? Everything crashes, and in comes FDR with all of these things to help the poor and things of that nature. I think that as Europe runs into its version of the 1920s, that there will be significant changes, and they'll be looking around for help. And I think they will recognize, here's the problem they'll have. And I think they'll wake up to this. They will realize that the U.S. is not on their side. And if you are a German businessman, if you're a European businessman, you've been told by the Russian, by the US, you don't want to get energy from the Russians. You don't want to do business with the Russians because they're untrustworthy and they will hold it over your head. You're now seeing that if you move your industry to the US, you are done. Everything they tell you to do, you best do, or they will cut you off.
Yeah. Are you aware of a French writer called Emmanuel Todd? Todd wrote, I think it was back in the early 2000s, a book in which he predicted that very thing. He said that the United States would become predatory towards Europe, and that it was in effect an empire in decline, but one which was going to become increasingly aggressive towards its own dependencies. And he said that eventually and in time, the Europeans will have to turn to the Russians to protect them from the United States.
Yeah, because
it's a curious thing.
And the marriage, you know, the partnership between the Europeans and the Russians is so obvious and natural. I mean, you've got these people who they've got industry, they've got a big market, they need natural resources, and right next to them is a giant store of natural resources that would love to sell all the resources and everyone's happy. The problem is that the U.S. Sees this as a geostrategic issue as opposed to an economic issue. There's a book that I would refer. It's hard to find that Tony Blinken wrote in 1987 called Ally versus Ally. And in that book, he basically discuss the Siberian oil pipelines and the partnerships, his problems and the issues of the neocons with the partnership between Russia and the United States because of the oil pipelines, and how that the Europeans saw that as purely economic and that it would work in their best interest. And the U.S. saw it as geostrategic. Basically, we can't control these people. And we can't keep the Russians down. So, of course, we can't keep the Russians, the Germans, you know how that goes, down, the Germans being the economic engine. We can't execute the NATO priorities if this is going on. So this is it's clear to see why the Nord Stream pipeline complex was such a problem for the neocons. This was that they felt if this thing is turned on, it's game, set, and match. We'll never convince the Europeans to decouple from the Russians. So they had to start this, fire this war up, and they had to blow the pipelines. But again, they're so inept that they're mismanaging even what they're doing now. And it's going to come back to haunt them pretty bad.
Indeed. Well, I've been talking for about 45 minutes now. I think perhaps, Alex, you've got some points to discuss with Garland. And
Garland, a question that someone threw out there in the beginning of the chat, and I'd like to throw it your way. How intimidated is Putin by Biden's midterm victory?
Well,
and I want to add something to it. When Biden was asked by a reporter, are you going to change anything with regards to Ukraine? Biden said nothing. He was asked about domestic policy, foreign policy, and Ukraine. He said nothing, not one thing. What does that tell you?
Well, it just tells me that he knows he doesn't have to, because both parties in the United States are captured by the same groups, the military industrial complex, et cetera, are, they're the only difference in the U.S. It works like this. Whichever party's in power, let's say you're a millionaire or you're a military industrial corporation and you're giving away $1 million. The party in power gets $750. The party out of power gets the other $250. If you're in power, you get the bigger share. You're from the same person. So I don't think he feels that he has to, because his constituency, which is the donor class, which is the corporate powerful oligarch class, are not requesting that he does. I don't think anything changes. I think the collective Putin, as they say, I think that the Russian leadership recognizes the patterns of the U.S. They recognize their motives. They recognize the outcome that they're pushing for. And, you know, individual moves on a day-to-day basis are irrelevant. Once you realize your adversary, once you realize their patterns and what they're doing, what they do on a given day-to-day basis, we discuss on various talk shows and things like that, but they kind of know where they're going, and now it's a long-term thing. You can look at the Iran nuclear deal. You can look at Biden now saying he's going to talk to Xi, and he's going to figure out his red lines, and he's going to talk about their red lines. They all know it's an absurdity. They know that the United States diplomacy in the U.S. is the art of saying nice doggy until you can get a rock and kill the dog. And that's the diplomacy they expect.
Yeah. Okay, I can just add something to that, because the Russians have commented several times in the run-up to the midterms, and they said that the midterms are not going to change anything at all. The Russians have seen no evidence. This is, you know, this comes from people like Peskov, that, you know, they're aware of the midterms, they follow the midterms, but they have no expectations of any change in policy at all. And I think that's the truth.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Did you want to add something?
What we'll see is some, I think you will see some investigations by the Republicans that may be embarrassing to Biden and Hunter Biden and things of that nature. Some things like that. I think that the investigations will be investigations on behalf of the deep state, so that they find that Biden is connected to China. They're not looking into Ukraine. Biden did something bad, and the word China is going to be thrown in there. They're going to do a number of, they'll investigate COVID. It was China. Here's an easily discoverable secret. The result of all investigations for the Republicans will focus on what China did and how they're our adversary. They're going to be, you know, puppets for the deep state in the same way that the Republicans are. And it's blatantly obvious. I mean, in the same way that the Democrats are, excuse me.
Right, right. Let me throw another question your way, and let me add some context to it as well. This is from AD. The Russians are going for full mobilization, definitely not freezing of the conflict. They cannot keep 500,000 soldiers mobilized forever. So logically, a huge action is coming. Do not forget Afghanistan. The Americans are empty. Does the American public remember Afghanistan, what happened there? Or has that completely left the memory of the American people?
It's completely gone. It's completely gone. And the reason is because of the media. The media certainly, you know, just lunges, actually with America, you know, it's the media lunges from one 24-hour news cycle to the next. In fact, I'll say this, one of the things that the media has to do in the United States is keep things current. The media cannot allow people to view things through a historical context, because if we look through a historical context, we might go back to 2014. We might go back to 2007. They can't allow that. Everything has to be, this thing started in February 24th. And then once that happened, we start today with whatever narrative they're pushing forward. So, I don't think Afghanistan is an issue at all, simply because it's disappeared from the U.S. media's, you know, discussion.
Right. M. Wick says, I'm concerned about the West being reactivated. Reports were starting to phase out the Ukraine narrative. Military, a sound decision, but I doubt that it will be politically the right approach. The neocons must be emboldened by everything that has happened the last week. Correct, Garland? The midterm results, I imagine, left them feeling pretty satisfied, and everything that's happened in Ukraine must leave them very encouraged. What do you think the neocons are going to do?
I don't think the neocons, you know, are as reactive to the things going on around as we would like to believe. I think the neocons have a view of the world and a long-term plan. If you look at what they've been doing, you know, look at the same people. If you look at how the continuity of the U.S. policies and the neocon policy from administration to administration, we talk about individual events. I think they see the big picture. We want to maintain unipolarity. We want to be the king of the earth. And that's that. And whatever happens, the individual chess moves that happen, they just simply see as, well, we have to move this king over here. We have to move this knight over here. But it's all part of their ultimate, you know, there was a cartoon that used to come on here in the U.S. called Pinky and the Brain. And it was a mouse. And every week when it came on, there was a new plan to rule the world. And I think that's where what are we going to do this week, Pinky? You know, and it was always the same thing. They're going to come up with a plan to rule the world. And that's where they are.
Right. What do you really think Jake Sullivan told Zelensky when he was in Kiev? And what do you think Jake Sullivan told the Russians this past week as well?
Well, you know, I think that Jake Sullivan, that his moves are, of course, as I said earlier, they're just trying to hold off the Europeans as long as they can, because Europe's economy is collapsing. So it was like, we've got to have some kind of a new narrative. You know, the fact of the matter is this: Zelensky is an actor, and he has a lot of, theatrical players around him who have a history in theater. So they understand what they're doing. So when they have these discussions, they are theatrical discussions. So it was, hey, this narrative is collapsing. What do we have to do for the next act? Do we need another villain? Do we need another bad guy? And it is a theatrical discussion. And so I think that they are probably very open. What's going on? Well, the Europeans are in the streets. How are we going to deal with that? Well, we've got to tell them that we're going to negotiate, blah, blah, blah. Maybe we can get 60 days out of that. And I think those are the kind of discussions they have.
And what about the Russians? How are they looking at this when they have Sullivan, perhaps according to the Wall Street Journal, speaking with Patrushev, and supposedly Sullivan is telling the Russians, let's not risk escalation? That's according to what the Wall Street Journal is reporting. But what do you really think there, So what do you think the message that Sullivan is conveying to the Russians is?
Well, first of all, that let's not risk escalation is not a message to the Russians. It's a message to the American people. People, you're starting to see people go to AOC or Bernie Sanders or different people screaming and yelling at them saying, we don't want a nuclear war. We don't want. So the message that we don't want to escalate is, hey, I'm telling you, basically, they're saying to the American people, I'm telling the Russians that we don't want to escalate when they know better and the Russians know better. And the Russians know that the neocons will escalate, you know, a bit at a time as best they can. They'll stick their feet in the water a little bit to see how what the temperature is and draw back a little bit. I think the Russians understand something. Ultimately, that a military victory in Ukraine settles this matter. And that military victory doesn't have to be, and I would even argue, shouldn't be an overwhelming offensive. It should be a collapse wherein there's nothing left. See, if there's a sudden victory coming and the Ukrainians are suddenly, you know, they're all running for the hills and they're being chased by tanks, then the neocons are like, well, what do we do? Should we move now? They're attacking. Should we attack? Should we blah, blah, blah. But if it's a kind of a slow motion collapse and the Ukrainian political and economic and military foundation is collapsing, there's nothing for the neocons to come in and refloat and protect. So I think the Russians realize we got to just wear the foundation of this thing down and allow it to collapse. And then the neocons can't, what are they going to do if it collapses? There's nothing to come in and refloat and rearm and protect.
Right. You have time for a couple more questions,
sure,
Garland?
Certainly.
All right. Why won't the, wait, let me rephrase this. Should the United States move troops into Ukraine, NATO, the United States, Romania, Poland, what would the reaction be in the U.S., do you think, if Biden, if NATO, if they say, you know what, let's move troops in now, given what has happened in Kherson. Now is the time. Now is the time for us to shore up our gains in Ukraine to solidify our position there. Do you think that's possible? But more importantly, what do you think the reaction would be in the U.S.?
I think they'd have a lot of problem with that. I think that is a bit too far. And I think the Americans would start to really get afraid and they get a lot of pushback on that. And keep in mind, from a military perspective, look, the Russians are the U.S., what if the NATO has 40,000 troops and they just put in the 82nd Airborne or 101st, whoever they are, 4,500 troops. They don't even have tanks, et cetera. And the Russians are sitting there with 500,000 troops that are going to be there in another month and firepower all over the place. It would be a token move. If they did, if they were to put in the amount of firepower that NATO and the U.S. has right now, it wouldn't really be competitive if the Russians decided, OK, it's all out war. They'd be wiped out. And where do you go from there? The escalation goes right to some kind of a nuclear thing and we're all done. So I think they're moving troops around as far as the chess move. But if I know that and you know that, the people in the Pentagon know that, and they're not going to throw their, they're thrilled about throwing the Ukrainians and the Poles and any other schmucks that are willing to give their lives, throw them right into a wood chipper. But they're not willing to do that. And I keep always go back to this. You are what your record says you are. When the U.S. uses proxies and when those proxies get, ask the Kurds, I mean, on and on, when those proxies get in trouble, every time in history, the U.S. pulls out, it claims it's going to come in, but it pulls out and it leaves them to get torn to pieces. I don't believe in the long run that they're going to go in and bail out the Ukrainians. They've never done it in history. You can make an argument that this is different. Maybe they'll do something different, but it's even worse because there's so much firepower there for the Russians.
Right. To both of you, a question. The Russians have lost their bridgehead.
Yeah.
They've lost their bridgehead. Obviously, Odessa, Nikolaev, Odessa moving west is not going to happen in the short to medium term. At least that's my view of things. Do you think that Putin is perhaps looking to solidify the position in Donbass? Create the defensive line east of the Dnieper, and then move this this conflict or put much more focus on the economic component to this war. Economic component with regards to Ukraine, economic component with regards to the European Union, and kind of look at the United States and say, you know, I'm sicking the economy of Ukraine. I'm sicking the economy of the European Union. Mm. Balls in your court, Biden White House. How much money are you willing to move into the center of the table? How many chips are you willing to move in with regards to keeping the EU afloat and keeping Ukraine afloat? Do you think something like that could be at play? Because from a military standpoint, I'm not an expert, as Alexander says, but it just seems that we're not going to see big moves from the Russians, or at least big westward moves from the Russians anytime soon. I'm not saying it's not going to happen. I just don't see it happening anytime soon. Meanwhile, there is a very active economic war, as you explained, Garland. There is an economic push and pull that is happening in Ukraine and in the European Union. Do you think that's going to be the center of this conflict? To both of you, gentlemen.
Yeah. I think it's going to be both. I think there's going to be both the military and the economic. I don't think you can separate them. So certainly I think that the priority is going to be to break Ukrainian resistance in Donbass. If you listen to Putin, if every single speech, every single interview, every single comment he's ever given about the special military operation, it always comes back to Donbass. He always talks about Donbass because, in a sense, that's where the conflict began. And that's, of course, the big industrial area in the east. And he's got to break the Ukrainian resistance there and gain control of Donbass. Now, if he gains control of Donbass, people who are better informed about these things than I am tell me that there is nothing to prevent the Russians advancing all the way to the Dnieper. So they can move all the way up to the Dnieper line, and they've already got the land bridge to Crimea. So he's got to do that. He can't stop until he's done that, the military side of things, until he's done that. Now, remember, they've given up their bridgehead in the south, which is in Kherson region. And yes, that's absolutely correct. Odessa is no longer within reach. I mean, probably at the beginning there was a plan to go on to Odessa, but this has now been put aside for the moment. They do, of course, have lots of troops in Belarus who, remember, are west of the Dnieper. So if they ever want to put pressure on Ukraine from the... I'm not saying they will, but if they want to do it from there, they can. But certainly, the military side of this has not ended. They will want, I think, to push all the way to the Dnieper. The economic war will continue. The economic war is being waged relentlessly against Ukraine. Ukraine's economy is now in a tailspin. I've just seen more reports that their GDP is going to contract a lot more because of the power shortages and power cuts. That goes without saying, of course. So Ukraine's economy is in a tailspin. It's becoming increasingly difficult for it to sustain itself. It's becoming an increasing burden on its European and Western allies. And of course, the Europeans are in those problems too. So yes, I think it's a war of attrition in both terms, a war of attrition in military terms, grinding the Ukrainian army down, and a war of attrition in economic terms, grinding down Ukraine's economy and putting enormous, increasing pressure on that of Europe.
Let me add this. And also, if you look at the war, okay, Russia is involved in the military aspect of the war, but there is a diplomatic / political aspect that Russia and China are involved in the war, in the diplomat, in the political diplomatic part of this war, Russia and China are fighting together, and they have taken Africa. They've taken South America. They just took Vietnam the other day. I mean, if you're talking about taking Kherson or taking, you know, Severodonetsk or whatever, if you talk about it with the same terms politically and diplomatically, just Vietnam, the U.S. wanted bases there. So Russia and, recently there were articles, I did a video on them, Mali, Niger, Haiti, Nigeria, I mean, country after country, the protesters were flying Russian and Chinese flags, which is their kind of way to give the finger to the U.S. and say, we've chosen sides. They've taken Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia say it's going to BRICS. Let's be honest. They've taken Turkey. Russia said, hey, how would you like to make a lot of money off of, you know, your economy's not doing so well. You know, you can make a lot of money with gas. And Erdogan said, I'm in. So if they, you hold a military town here and you hold someone in place so you can take a town over here, what if you hold the military, strong points in the military, so that you can diplomatically and politically take country after country, region after region, till it gets to the point. Saudi Arabia is the big prize, I think. Saudi Arabia is the big diplomatic economic prize, because if you're looking at creating some kind of a new currency based on a basket of commodities, Venezuela, Russia, and Saudi Arabia on the same team, that's game, set, and match. And Saudi Arabia has the petrodollar. At that point, the neocons are looking over here at Ukraine or wherever, and you are just snatching their economic heart out going for that petrodollar. Right now, that's the big one. And that's lost because the Saudi Arabian leaders despise Joe Biden. So I think they are not disconnecting these, and they're saying, we'll take this town and this town, but we'll take this country, this region, Middle East. What can we get here? You know, there's a battle for Pakistan. So I see them all as one, and I see the Russia, China, maybe Russia, China, India, interestingly enough, strange bedfellows, India and China, as a partner. But you know, India had a lot of issues with China. I think Russia's working hard to mend fences there. And really, India has no choice, because India aspires to be a world power. And they're saying, holy moly, look what are happening to these other countries when they aspire to be a world power. The U.S. takes them out. And 5-10 years from now, when we get on that footing, they're going to take us out. India has no choice but to join that coalition, regardless of their issues with China. They know that they're next on the menu.
All right. Let's finish it off with one more question. Once again, to both of you, let's look ahead to the G20, which is taking place on the 15th and the 16th. But a day before the G20, we have Biden meeting with Xi Jinping. This is an official heads of state meeting. What do you guys expect Biden to tell Xi Jinping?
Well, he's going to tell him all the usual things, that he supports the one China policy, even as he busily undermines it. He's going to tell Xi Jinping that China and the United States have a shared interest in strategic stability, even as he does all the time, takes more and more steps to try to undermine China. Like, for example, the chip export ban and things of that kind. So he's going to talk nice words to Xi Jinping without actually meaning them. And obviously we're going to be hearing about, you know, the sort of strategic, the attempts to sort of set out red lines. But Xi Jinping has already made it clear that he doesn't trust Biden. He's actually said this to Biden directly in previous meetings that they've had. It's there in the readouts. So, yes, they will have their conversations. They will they're maneuvering around each other. But fundamentally, the problem is that the trust between them has gone.
I don't know what else to add to that, because that's 100%. I expect that what will happen is that the discussion between those two men, neither of them will speak to each other. in that Biden will say things for the consumption of his home audience, both the neocons in Washington, D.C., to somehow remind them I'm on your side, to say to the American people, no, we're the good guys and we're just trying to work things out with the evil Chinese. I think that Xi Jinping will make statements to send the message to the broader world, we're not fooled. We know who these people are. I think he will send the message home to the Chinese people to say, I stand resolute and my, you know, we have my spine is strong and we will stand up against whoever tries to push back and we are a powerful country. So neither one of them, interestingly enough, will be speaking to the other because everybody knows where they stand.
Very quickly, before we end it, to both of you, Garland, Alexander, is there a Minsk 3? On the table, there's a lot of rumors and talk about a Minsk 3. Do you think that is being floated?
No, actually. I should say that the Russians, I mean, there's been a lot of talk about discussions, about negotiations and things of this kind. And we've heard all the stories about Patrushev and Sullivan talking to each other. The Russians are busy pouring cold water on all of that. And I think that after Minsk 2, which was frankly, a complete failure from a Russian point of view, I don't think they have any interest in a Minsk 3.
Yeah, I would have to agree. I mean, you know, I've done work with contracts, and I don't care what you write into a contract. There must be some level of trust between the two parties that are drawing up the contract. At this point, let's not forget, Petro Poroshenko literally came out and said, we just wrote the Minsk Accords up to keep the Russians off until we could build our military up enough to fight them. So they know that there would be no point in it. I'll put it like this. It's possible that the Russians may, if the U.S. wants to negotiate, if the Europe says we want to negotiate for Minsk 3, that the Russians will send a team to negotiate and that they'll negotiate in, you know, but it seemingly in earnest, but they'll already know the outcome. So yes, may they kind of do a pro forma thing to make it appear that they're negotiating? Yes, but the Russians already know. And you know, I think most people know how this ends. The Russians have to, here's the point. The Russians have said, you have come up to the border of a superpower. We're going to run you off our border. The US has said, you can't run us off your border. There's the way this ends is either they run the US off their border or they don't. There is no other way this happens. And so I think the rest of these things are, you know, the discussions, the time for working out deals is long past for the Russians. And, you know, they understand who the neocons are. You can't trust them.
Yeah.
Fantastic. On that note, we will wrap this live stream up. All the questions, we will answer all the questions that were sent to us in a separate dedicated video. Thank you to our moderators, Zariel, Valies, Reckless Abandon. And I think that is everyone that was moderating this live stream. And of course, a big, big thank you to the one and only Garland Nixon. All of Garland's information is already in the description box as to where to follow his channels. And I will place them as a pinned comment as well. Alexander and Garland, final thoughts before we sign off.
I mean, it's been an important week, but I think we can perhaps overestimate the importance of this week. I think the Kherson withdrawal and the midterms, when the dust settles, we'll probably realize that they've actually changed things, the overall picture, far less than some of the headlines might imply. And I think that's my own personal take. I think overall, the situation remains pretty much as it was last week. Events moving pretty much in that same direction.
And I think this was a very good discussion because the discussions in amongst many pundits is the relationship between the U.S. and Russia, the U.S. and China. But I think this was a good discussion because what's important is in the long run is the relationship between the United States and Europe. That's what decides it all, as does Europe wake up to realize that the United States is simply grabbing their industry and moving it home and do anything about it, and which would be at the kind of working class person on the street level. And I think that's the relationship to keep an eye on.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well said. Thank you once again to Alexander London. Thank you. A big, big thank you to Garland Nixon. Thank you to our moderators. Thank you to everyone that was watching us on Rockfin. You can find us on Rockfin, on Rumble, on Odyssey, on YouTube, of course, and to our locals community, the durand.locals.com. Thank you very much for all of your questions, and we will be back soon. Have a great weekend, everybody.